I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development to order for Wednesday, June 5th, 2019. I will open informational meeting and will continue our discussion on economic development investments and incentive review. And looks like Art Fish and John Saris is going to come up here. You both want to come up at the same time? You want to have an arm wrestle for who goes first or how? You're going to let Art go first, I assume.
I think Art wins, his slides are first.
Oh, his slide's already up there, so.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, welcome.
Well, yes, thank you, Chair Lively, Vice Chair Fahey, Vice Chair Bonham, and members, honorable members of the House Committee on Economic Development.
Are there any?
I really appreciate the chance to come back and talk about what we love to do. And again, I'm Art Fish with Business Oregon, and the last time I was here, it was with our director, Chris Harder, and we went through some programs that rely mainly on cash, and I got into really our workhorse for economic development with respect to tax incentives. We talked about a few things. That's the standard enterprise zone program, 3 to 5 year exemption. It's kind of busy, has a diverse role. It helps a lot of different businesses. Many of them are quite small with smallish investments, but it's a property tax again. Locally administered by and large. I would just note that I'm kind of in the process now. We get annual reports from assessors based on the annual filings of the Department of Revenue forms. The business is receiving these 3 to 5 year exemptions on new qualified property. And I'll be working with the Department of Revenue and, of course, our local partners with the county assessors to check up on a lot of that data and these firms and stuff like that just to help them with not only compliance, but also for our analysis, a lot of which ends up in the tax expenditure report every 2 years. So with that, kind of having talked here, kind of finished here with that standard enterprise zone program, which is, you know, has a great deal of activity, relatively speaking, I'm going to move on to, I guess, more kind of three, I call them niche players. They're much more targeted programs. One doesn't require a new slide. It's actually indicated up there. And that is what we call the Long-Term Rural Enterprise Zone Facility Program. And I say it's more targeted. I mean, we've only got, you know, 8 or so companies that have been using it. It's a longer-term exemption, 7 to 15 years, in fact. So that is quite a bit longer. It's a single period that starts once the facility is up. It has some very specific job requirements. You have to, you know, it's not just, you know, a certain increase from where the business starts, but depending upon where they're located relative to I-5 and the size of the county, it might be as many as 75 people total, new full-time persons working. Could be 50, 35, and then in the more rural areas, as little as 10 people. So it has that, has a, you know, high wage and compensation requirements and some minimum investment standards. So it is more targeted. It's also more targeted geographically. Not only does it have to be inside an enterprise zone again, but it has to be one of these rural enterprise zones in a county that is satisfying, you know, kind of some economic, considerable ongoing economic hardship data respective to, you know, the country and just being rural and so forth. So, you know, it's been used about 12 exemptions. We have a few more, only in 4 counties so far at the moment, but we do have a few more. Lamb Weston, you heard about in Houston, Hermiston would use this. There is the Dutch Bros facility in Grants Pass that would actually get into this program, and even the Red Rocks in Lakeview. So it does really serve. And that's its purpose, is really to help drive very special projects out into rural areas, and it's definitely done that. The data centers you hear a lot about, and they account for an awful lot of the property tax impact of this program. I think that leads to sort of a but-for argument in terms of the local decision making is very. You know, there's nothing automatic here. There's some discretion. It has to be resolutions adopted, a local agreement. So you do have county and city officials weighing that. And, you know, one could argue that, you know, I mean, to the extent this was critical for the data centers or the lumber things in Douglas or some of the food processing in Morrow County, you know, it makes a huge difference. And it makes a huge difference for those communities. I mean, the Dalles has been transformed. I mean, Crook County is moving out because it's not a lot of jobs in terms of, so if you're looking at statewide and trying to balance the job tax thing and that payback element, as well as the length of time before the property gets back on the rolls with this program compared to the 3 to 5, you know, the payback's not as robust. But it has, I think, you know, it does serve a much more greater but for. You can make the certainly the case that with these data centers, you know, I mean, Oregon's attractive. There's always other factors. So, you know, we have power that's affordable. We have no sales tax in Oregon. So we're probably the best place in the country for data centers and other things. But at the same time, other places are right behind us. And there's no doubt, I don't know if anything else would have come along and put anywhere near that much property down that would have ever paid property taxes or gotten an exemption. So, but, you know, you have to weigh all those. We're quite sure all these companies are meeting these high standards hand over fist. There was one case, though, we did have a second sort of facility proposed by Riddle. To expand a facility, and it didn't have enough of the 75 more jobs, and so we had to, have the back, and I worked with the assessor and the department to get those, make sure those property taxes were paid back.
So the clawback provisions for the enterprise, for those zones that are that much longer are similar to the clawback provisions?
Yeah, there's some force majeure qualifiers in there if something happens beyond a firm's control, as I was just looking at yesterday. But if they don't, if they fall below the job numbers or the pay levels, whatever, I mean, they have to meet the investment pretty early on, of course, then all up to all 15 years. And it doesn't have to be 15 years. We've had 10-year and 8-year exemptions with this program, but, you know, companies want the 15, and then they obviously negotiate other things. And I think that leads into strategic investment program, which is really all about that local negotiation. It doesn't have any job requirements. We do get, we can talk further, but we actually get an excellent annual report at the agency ourselves directly from the businesses with this program. And it does show quite a lot of job creation. A lot of that is with the big user of this program also in terms of property, and that is the Intel Corporation. And this program's been around for many years. Its main deal is you have to invest a certain amount before the exemption kicks in. So taxes are still paid on this property, this taxable portions up there, and then the property in excess is exempt, and the company needs to pay a community service fee, and that's built into the local agreement. And it does even provide for some of that monies to be distributed back out to some of the other local taxing districts, which is kind of, I think, one of the things that makes this program so good. And it has actually been used, we've had a good 21 projects that have actually used this, or using it now, or have gone through and finished the 15 years or whatever, including some of the early things by Intel that started in 1994 and then in 1999. So it's been a real performer, I mean, but it just serves kind of as a purpose, the local interest in kind of being able to work with companies that might have actually very out of whack kind of property tax effects, and working on a different method. And so Washington County, for example, negotiates that, you know, they get other fees that equate roughly in a forecasted way to the taxes that might otherwise be paid on the buildings and structures, such that the exemption then to Intel, in this case, and Genentech, I suppose, is really more or less just for all the machinery and equipment, which, of course, in Intel's case, is just way out of any normal consideration. The other things, and this has been serving in rural areas, though not with as much job creation, because it's energy. Energy generation isn't as it is capital intensive, but not so much jobs. But we have had, and we are getting increasing interest or looking at this for other opportunities around the state. It's been mainly along the very northern tier of the state, Washington County, and then some of the wind farms and natural gas even across things. So that's SIP, which I'm happy to talk about further.
So can you give us an example of a something besides Intel, some other company in the state.
There's something besides Intel?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there have been the, you know, the Caithness Flats, Shepherd's Farm, wind farms. Those have created 40 jobs across, so that's a good one. We have
a company that creates the kind of jobs and pays the kind of thing. I'm trying to get to the impact on community, and I appreciate wind farms being out there.
Yeah.
But part of the, I mean, if you look up here at the jobs and the jobs retaining, I'm trying to understand what other projects in this state have been that are big enough to take advantage of.
Only a few hundred are really not Intel. Intel and Genentech, I should say. We do have Georgia Pacific using this at the WANA facility in Clatsop County. They've got 40 jobs pinned on this, but I mean, there's already 1,000 already out there in the wood products industry, which has not been in a major growth mode. But it's a good, that's a good thing. We do have Amazon coming into this program now. They had been using the 3 to 5 year enterprise zone in Morrow and Umatilla, but in Umatilla, they've got another $5 billion to invest and have worked out a very good deal, at least from the Umatilla County's perspective. Again, this doesn't have any specific job requirements, so you know, we can only say that they're expected to add another couple hundred, which is quite significant, and do a lot of other good things in Umatilla County. So that's another one which will start probably in the next, in this coming year.
And the community service fee that's negotiated, so some of that money could go to schools, it could go to local governments, it can go to whoever the local wants to negotiate for the money to go to.
Yes, I mean, there's two elements there. There's the community service fee that's built into the law, which is the greater or the lesser of a certain $2 million or $2.5 million. It depends upon when the agreement was done. Or 25% of the property tax savings. And that then is subject to a second agreement among local taxing districts and some others. But with only a few exceptions, there's been other payments that companies have agreed to make. And I think it's from those sorts of things that we've seen Washington County, for example, donate funds to the school districts and stuff like that.
Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I understand it, for the community service fee, that's by agreement, and the entities can have additional requirements that are put on as part of that agreement. Is that right?
Vice Chair Fahey, Chair Lively, members of the committee. Yes, that's correct. I mean, actually, the way to put it is the community service fee is required in statute to be in the agreement and for the company to pay. It's the one thing that, you know, they could, if they didn't pay it, our commission would wait, would come back in. And I meant to note, our commission actually does play a formalistic role in the procedures to actually approve these projects at the outset. But they do have, with this agreement, the ability to negotiate other requirements, many of which have often take the form of other payment streams for certain reasons, as I alluded to with Intel and the building, but yeah. So, but they're at their own, they're at their own reconnaissance on all of that as far as the counties and cities go.
Do you happen to know what, if there are other requirements for some of these agreements, like particularly, you know, intelligent, the people who are the biggest users of this program, are there other requirements that are agreed upon in those agreements?
Vice Chair Fahey, Chair Lively, members of the committee, you know, I think, I don't really recall any that aren't in the form of monetary sort of things. I think when it comes to the jobs and the employment, a lot of that's taken for, you know, that's taken, you know, I mean, if they do it, they're going to hire what they hire. And so I guess at the local level, they haven't felt that they need anything. But as far as people having a sort of minimum, they have to, bar they have to meet just to use the program, there's nothing in statute. So it is a local decision as far as anything like that. But I mean, there's probably been goodwill things, you know, charitable donations, you know, training, I think, is a big part of the thing with Amazon at this point, is they're going to, you know, they're going to create quite a bit of training apparatus, infrastructure to serve themselves as much as anything. But it does I guess, help the Umatilla County communities quite a bit, too.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's property taxes. I mean, that's it. I mean, there are some other property tax exemptions for construction and food processing, which are not my, we don't really deal with them much in a way, but they are, they do exist as tax expenditures, so.
Yeah. Representative Bredo, excuse me. Sure.
So is that personal property tax as well as regular property tax?
Representative Barreto, Chair Lively, members of the committee. In Oregon, real, what's called real property, is which is, you know, everything that's really, everything, if you will, that's solid and on the ground, and personal property are very much treated the same. There are some agricultural and other distinctions out there, but they get the same tax rate. They're subject technically to the same sort of assessment rules. And all of these exemptions, to the best of my knowledge, pretty much don't, I mean, they don't make a strict distinction of one or the other. They may have certain requirements about, you know, what the personal property has to be or can be, and stuff like that with the enterprise zones. But the strategic investment program, for example, is everything on up. And you start with the land and the buildings as far as what's covered by the taxable portion.
So,
go ahead.
So equipment, you know, that you put into the building, like Intel does, like they do in the data centers, I was thinking it was a different rate than what your real property is. Your real property is the structure. And so, so you get taxed on both. And this program here, I guess what I'm asking is does it exempt both taxes?
Okay. Yeah. And I would just note, I mean, they are treated differently in reality out there because, you know, personal property will tend to just depreciate, of course. So the Measure 50 effects and stuff don't necessarily apply to it, hardly ever. So it's always taxed at what it's worth in real market value, probably as much as anything. Real estate, of course, is more subject to Measure 50 types effects. But in Oregon, we don't statutorily make a distinction as far as different assessment rates or tax rates like we see in other states.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so I'll go on. Again, this is one of our, I mean, and again, I should note that long-term enterprise zones, strategic, especially the strategic investment, do have major revenue impacts. I mean, they involve a lot of property, hopefully not otherwise be there some way or another to that magnitude. This program deals with income taxes, but in a probably much more modest, well, very, very modest way relative to those property tax programs. And we're really down to only six businesses, but we've had a good 20 over time and with about 1,000 jobs over the years. A lot of those are out of the program, and we've got some more coming in. So we're just kind of at a little bit of a trough right now with this program. But what it does, it's not a tax credit. As I noted when I began the other day, we don't really have tax credits in Oregon, income tax credits related to economic development. We do have this, and it's a subtraction. So if we want to get into that sort of wonky revenue committee stuff, you know, this is where they take the taxable income on the facility and they subtract it from how much they pay taxes on, they being a business. And if the facility,
income tax.
Yes, the income tax, corporate or personal in the case of a pass-through company. So the focus here, the targeting, is really just very rural. Right now, we've got 15 counties in the program. We've had Columbia County in here, and I think this was very instrumental in getting this Cascade Tissue thing that went into Coopers area lately. And we'll be starting to use this program any day now. And so it was very useful there. But I mean, we base it on economic statistics, kind of like with the long-term rural program for enterprise zones. But in this case, it can be anywhere in the county, subject to a variety of little requirements. And so, again, with this program, there's actually quite a long list of requirements that I put into the testimony. It can be a little daunting. As far as the sheer job creation, it's not really, it may be complicated, but it's not real hard. It's only five new people. And again, I think that's reflective of where this has been targeted to areas that have very, you know, very limited potential for major job creation. But it has worked, and some of the programs, you know, I mean, like Cascade Tissue might have 71, the first Lowe's distribution center in Oregon outside of Lebanon has created several hundred that are going strong. So it's a good program. We actually administer it at the agency. I do. We get the certifications preliminarily at the beginning, make sure they're in the right place. They're not going to compete locally. They're going to be doing something unique to the company. They're going to have five jobs. Then they get approved. They can do the facility. They have to do it pretty soon, or they kind of lose the option. Then they wait 24 months to start claiming this exemption or subtraction on tax returns, subject to us issuing an annual certification each year, based on their filing or their application to us each year, based on sort of things. So
what's the role, if any, for the local, for the county? So I'm trying to, you just decide who, what counties get this or not?
Okay. Okay, our role, we have to look at the county data.
Okay.
And decide which counties are eligible based on, effectively at this time, in the last 2-3 years, have they been both among the worst half of counties in Oregon in terms of annual unemployment and per capita income. So that sort of double test, it used to work a little differently at times, and we had a few more in the program, but it does limit it. I think we're going to lose Malheur County at the end of this year, so we'll be down to 14. So we make that, and then our decision with the businesses is equally just as ministerial. We just go off of what they have. I mean, you know, I'll try to investigate, you know, make sure it's really five people, and that sort of thing. But it's not terribly challenging. There is, though, it's income tax and whatever else. There is a role for local governments that was built into this from the get-go, and it's been around a while, and it has served its function out there in some of these rural areas with some good projects, including a lot of small companies. I like to highlight PC Energy distributor out of Ontario. The locals have an option at the time of preliminary certification to object within 60 days by resolution, either city, county, port, if they find the facility would be, competitive, would undermine local employers, or doesn't meet sort of land use development type standards. So they do have kind of some control, but, again, the other things they really have control with, though not so much the three-year exemption with the enterprise zones, is predicated also on the fact that those other things that I talked about relate to local property taxes. So,
right. Thank you.
That's all I got.
Okay. Question?
No.
Representative Marsh.
I might not have been listening as carefully as I could have, but did you say that Malheur County is dropping out of this?
Representative Marsh, Chair Lively, members of the committee. their unemployment, they have the lowest per capita income in the state, mm-hmm. is Malheur County. Mm-hmm. So they're good for that measure for a good many years, but it looks like the unemployment rate has risen to the point where it's not among the 18 worst of counties around the state. So, it's kind of a hard cut in a way. A lot of counties are all around, even the highest county unemployment rate is now 7-8%. So, as the unemployment rates go down, it's not impossible for a county like Malheur to have a little bit of relative improvement, I suppose.
Hmm. And then
it's a relative.
One more question. Did you say whether or not there are any standards regarding pay for companies that are involved with this program?
Representative Marsh, Chair Lively, members of the committee. I didn't mention it, but there are.
Okay.
So at least the five people need to be paid at least, each of them, 150% or 130% of the, the county per capita income level. And then they have to, on average, have a wage equal or greater than the county wage, average wage. So there is some test there for at least a few very high quality hires relative to the communities.
One follow-up question?
Sure.
So given that, should we be looking at those markers that allow the program to be enrolled, like if Malheur, in that case, has a very low income, should we be using this program more to drive income levels as opposed to respond to unemployment?
Representative Marsh, Chair Lively, members of the committee. Yeah, I mean, that is obviously open to discussion. I mean, and like I say, this having to be both in the worst half, you know, used to be the worst third in both. And then at times it's been and it hasn't been both. It has to be one or the other. So you either have to be a certain low-ranking county as far as unemployment goes, or a low-ranking county as far as income goes. And so the legislature has revisited that issue at various times. I think the last time was 2013 that we really got, you know, it was really modified for a while. So, I mean, it is a good question. As we look around the state and find that maybe 14 or few so counties, because, you know, Oregon has 36 counties, but the number that are really, you know, year in, year out, doing the best economically is a fairly small number. It's where most people live, blessedly, but it is, you know, it is something worth revisiting. And so, yeah, no, it's very easy to jiggle these things and make them serve another bit of different targeting.
So, Chair Lively, I would just suggest we put that on our list of things to think about.
I think it was good questions. I mean, given the conditions of many of those counties and the issues you raise, that's a good follow-up.
Yeah.
Representative Helm, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remembered that I thought we passed a rural SIP provision a couple years ago that would apply to towns and cities 40,000 and below, and I see that in the statute that you provided us that it's there.
Mm-hmm.
It's relatively new, if I remember right. It was 2015, 20, I don't know. So my question is, one, is my memory right? And then two, have we had any real movement for rural communities of that size to take advantage of this SIP?
All right. It's a bit complicated, but here we go. Representative Helm, Chair Lively, members of the committee. Yeah, the rural SIP, okay, originally this program required at least $100 million before the exemption began. So, I mean, in effect, you know, you have to invest a business. I always say you, but a business needs to invest a good few hundred million for this to really make sense, especially compared to an enterprise zone, just even a regular enterprise zone. And then in 2003, the legislature provided for a $25 million threshold in rural areas, and that's been modified so that it can grow if it really is a truly gigantic, you know, the Tony Hyde proposal, I think, of just 2 years ago. But you're right, in 2015, they redefined rural to be based on an urban growth boundary of less than 40,000. All right, it had been 30,000. So they actually raised it up so that this could still conceivably be based on these lower thresholds in effectively Grants Pass and McMinnville. And no, we have not seen this particular program used in those two communities, but it does show promise in other rural areas that would have been fine before. But, you know, we are seeing things. Lincoln, Lane would be urban, but you know, I do, you know, so hopefully we'll see more diversity in this program. It's not the most diverse of programs, strategic investment program, so.
Okay. Thank you, Art.
All right. We did that before. And now, Mr. Saris, and I would just know before I let off, and thank you all very much again for this, is that we're not just neighbors here, we're neighbors in real life.
Yes. Do I hold that against him or what? I mean,
here in Sweet Salem.
Yes. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you. Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Saris, and yes, Art Fish does have a piece of property right next to me, and we have very interesting conversations over the fence at times. So, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So I've been brought here today to come back to the committee and talk a little bit about the business finance programs we administer. We've talked about them in the past, but specifically to address a couple of questions raised. So today we'll go through those programs again, and we'll look to answer questions about what the conditions for approval may be for the programs, talk about whether or not the programs are achieving their purpose. So we'll have to talk a little bit about the purpose of the programs. We'll talk about how we monitor the programs to see if they may be working and if we may need to make changes or enhancements to them to make them more effective. And then two, talk about what happens if somebody using the program doesn't continue to repay the loans or meet the obligations of the program at that point in the form of clawbacks and things of that nature. So with that, so just as a quick refresher, there's three different types of programs that we administer, and we'll go through them one by one. But we have direct loan programs where the state actually lends money to a small business and they repay the loan with principal and interest. We have programs that we work very closely with financial institutions like banks and credit unions, where we're helping insure loans that may not otherwise be made. And then we have bond programs where the state doesn't have any obligation or risk, but we're determining that the projects meet eligibility requirements of the tax code, and the companies that qualify get a benefit of reduced borrowing costs with those programs. Before I dive into the individual programs, I would say that Oregon has very good, robust programs. They've been around often from the 1980s and 1990s, most of them established during those times. I would note that they were often established during recessionary periods. And so when these programs were created, they were often created to define or fill a unique gap in the business capital system that to help small businesses get the capital they needed to support growth, expansion, and economic diversification of our communities. For that end, again, the programs, we'll talk about the gaps that we'll be filling. We leverage private capital and not compete with it. We are looking for private financial institutions to provide a majority of the funding, and we're there to fill a gap that they can't. We really do focus, too, on Oregon's smallest businesses. For the most part, these companies that are qualifying have fewer than 25 employees. So they are Oregon's small entrepreneurs and growing companies. And then, too, there's a very big focus on rural companies. In rural communities, there's fewer sources of capital generally available. So the state created these programs to work with banks and credit unions to help improve accessibility of capital in rural communities. And then ultimately, the final thing that they're intended to do is improve the financial capacity of the businesses. We don't want them to have to rely continuously on public funding and support to have a viable business. We want them to graduate out of these programs and into more mainstream conventional lending sources. So last thing I'll just point out is that the funding for these programs is non-recurring. So we receive appropriations from the legislature intermittently. About 60% of the funding we have has come from the state of Oregon. About 40% has come from the federal government. We have about $65 million of assets under management. And during the time that these programs have been operating, we've helped small businesses access more than $2 billion of private capital. So very effective given the size of the investment that the state has made to date. Next slide, please. So when it gets to the administration of the programs, I wanted to highlight a couple of things that I think are very important is that we have a couple of things that the legislature has put into place to make sure that we have oversight for the programs. And one example of that is that the legislature requires that certain loans get approved by the commission in order to ensure that the state isn't at too much risk. As these programs were developed, again, in the 80s and 90s, the commission, which is really a policy body for the Economic Development Department, realized they didn't necessarily have the right skill set and tools to know whether or not we were making a good loan to a qualified business or not. So they actually created what's called their finance committee. In a bank or a credit union, this could be much like a loan committee. And so basically, this committee is appointed by the commission. They generally have experience in lending and financials and help us review and vet the credits. But this body also serves as a group that we take changes and enhancements to the programs that may make them better to make sure that they're sound and they wouldn't necessarily put the programs at risk. This group also, our finance committee, will review our loan portfolio with us. And we right now are doing it twice a year where we risk rate our portfolio. We look at the fund's performance. They talk about risk management with us. And we also learn about industries that we need to be aware of that are increasing in risk over time. So they really are our lending oversight. We do meet with them once a year. We happen to move those meetings around the state. We've been in Klamath Falls, in Astoria, in Coos Bay, in Pendleton. This year we'll be in Eugene. But that is something that we do with this group. A couple of things that we have done as we've vetted these projects is that we have made changes to statutes. A lot of times these programs, as time goes by, the value of a dollar changes. An example of that is that we've increased lending limits on one program for $750,000 to $1 million. It just makes it more effective. We've raised the limits for gross sales in one program from $350,000 to $500,000, again, making it more applicable to entrepreneurs and small businesses. So we're continuously looking for process improvements that's going to support the intended use of the program and continue to make them viable for our small business communities. When we approve loans, we're looking at really two different things regardless of the program. We're looking at our statutes that the legislature has provided us, where we have eligibility criteria. We further have administrative rules where we provide additional guidance regarding eligibility and preference. In order to approve any project, the very first thing we do is make sure that the projects comply with state statute and rule. And then from there, depending on the type of program we're working with, there's different levels of financial due diligence that we do to ensure that the credit risk is appropriate for the program. And we'll go through those a little bit on a case-by-case basis. So from here, we'll start into the programs. I obviously look forward to any questions the committee may have as we go through these, and we'll just kind of run through them one by one. We have about five or six slides that we'll go through, and hopefully I'm answering all the questions that you guys are looking for. So our first program is our bond program, industrial development bonds. This is one of the oldest programs we have. It's actually created and authorized by the Internal Revenue Code. So this essentially is a federal program, and the federal government provides the states on an annual basis amount of allocation to issue these bonds. And it's really based on a per capita. It's like $105 per capita. The state of Oregon gets roughly $400 to $450 million a year right now of this allocation. That allocation then goes to different types of bonds. Industrial development bonds is one, housing is another one that support small business and housing needs. What the bonds do and what the allocation does is basically for the purchaser of the bonds, the lender, if you will, the interest income that they get is exempt from interest or federal income tax. They can be exempt from state income tax, but there's some nuances there to qualify. So essentially what the bond purchaser does is they pass that exempt savings along to the borrower. So in today's interest rate environment, federal income tax, the max rate's 22%. A business looking at this could expect a probably 15% reduction in their cost of funds. So the role of the department as the issuer is to work with bond counsel. And because we're working with federal tax, we work with tax attorneys, and they basically are going to be determining that the project meets the eligibility requirements of the Internal Revenue Code. There's two main types of bonds that can be issued. One is for a traditional manufacturer. This would be a company in your town that's they've bought a piece of land, they want to put a new manufacturing facility in there, and so they could functionally finance the cost of the equipment and the improvements to that property. So those are capped by the federal code at $10 million a project, and they're really related to the fixed assets and the financing of fixed assets for the company. The other type is what's called an exempt facility bond, and this doesn't have a cap, and largely because the cost of these projects are much more expensive. These are recycling centers, sewage treatment facility, wharves and marinas, waste to energy projects, etc. And so the federal tax code really contemplates that the public benefit is through the recycling and other elements of those activities that the lower cost of funds is worthwhile from the federal code perspective. I did mention that some of these projects could be exempt from state income tax. In order to qualify for that, it would not be a financial institution or that would be lending the money. It would be an individual purchaser of the bond. So I would need to functionally, as an individual, qualify as a accredited investor and provide $4 million of capital for this project. As an individual, my income tax then would be exempt. We haven't seen that done since I've been at the state on an individual basis, just basically because of the large size of these projects. So about this program, again, our role really is to determine that the project meets the federal tax code eligibility requirements. We work with bond counsel to document that. In addition to our bond counsel, we work with the Oregon Department of Justice. They review these transactions and also work closely with the Debt Management Division with the Treasurer's Office to ensure that these projects are meeting the highest and best use of this bond allocation. And historically, with that $400 to $450 million of allocation received as a state, there hasn't been so much demand that we're using it all. Right now, though, that's changing. We have a lot of demand in the housing industry, and housing is going to be using a lot of this bond allocation. So for future projects, I would assume that the prioritization is going to go towards these housing projects around the state.
So if a business that builds a facility and for some reason they go out of business, market shift in that, so what happens from the standpoint of what's left to repay to the bonds?
So the bond, the purchaser of the bonds is basically responsible for getting repaid.
Okay.
And if there's a default, if you will, let's say that for some reason it's determined that the use of the proceeds wasn't eligible, essentially the tax benefit ceases and the interest rate then would go up. And again, that would be a default that the bond purchaser and the business would negotiate. So as far as utilization of this program, the one thing I would note too is that the federal tax code hasn't been updated in quite some time. Many of the limits are backdated to 1986. There are groups that are looking to make those more modern and more applicable. And if that happens, I think that more small businesses will be looking at this in the future. So that's the bond program, probably one of the more complicated tools. We'll go to next to our loan guarantee programs. We have two here. One thing to note for both of these that's common is that in order to qualify, well, what the loan program or what these programs do is basically insure loans that banks and credit unions are making. So in order to qualify for this insurance, one, you have to be a regulated financial institution. Then from there, we can back into the eligibility requirements. Our capital access program is unique in that it allows lenders to establish a loan loss reserve to help insure a pool of loans. And so what a lender will do is that to enroll in the program, they'll collect a fee from the borrower, they'll submit an application to the state, we'll review it, provided it's eligible, we'll match that fee, and that fee then goes sits in a loan loss reserve account at the financial institution. They'll continue to enroll loans and that fee pool will grow. And in the event that there's a default, the bank will liquidate the loans. And if there's a deficiency, they'll basically ask to be made whole through that loan loss reserve. A bank or credit union really needs to have a strategy to do this. You can't enroll loans on a one-off basis and expect a $3,000 fee to help cover a $100,000 credit loss. And so most banks that are credit unions that are using this have a plan in place. And what we see are they'll take smaller loans, say loans that vary between $50,000 and $100,000 for small businesses that are startups, they haven't been around for 3 years. They'll naturally just take all of the loans that they get and they'll enroll all of these in that program and helps generate a loan loss reserve that's adequate to cover their losses in the future. So that's how this program works. Our role is very minimal. We look to make sure that the uses of proceeds are eligible. In order to qualify, the proceeds cannot be used to refinance any existing debt. It cannot be used for the construction or acquisition of residential property. The use of proceeds can't be used for personal purposes. So very broad, very open. And our approval process and review process is generally about 24 hours. So this is a very quick and efficient program. If we get a claim and we determine that the use of proceeds wasn't eligible, basically the claim is denied, and the fee then is reimbursed back to the state. This very rarely happens. And the other thing we can do is cover a portion of the loan that may have been eligible. When we're working with a financial institution, we generally try to provide a little bit of latitude to help minimize some of the losses and basically let them know that the program is there to help them. So we use it as a training opportunity when it does come up, which isn't often. So our next program, staying with the loan guarantee programs, is our Credit Enhancement Fund. This program, very much like our last one, insures loans, but we insure the loans on a case-by-case basis. Because we're doing that, our exposure goes up a lot more. We're actually taking up to 75 or 80% of the exposure of the lender on each individual loan basis. So with this program, we actually do underwrite and review the loan ourselves as if we were making the loans. We basically then look at the terms and conditions that the lenders have made on the loans, and we want to make sure that we're properly protecting the interests of the state as if we're making a loan. If we want to add more conditions, we'll do that, and we negotiate that with the bank, and then they work with the borrower on those. Essentially, when we do a financial review, and this will very much apply to the next three programs that we look at, we're looking at underwriting just as if we were a bank or a credit union. We're going to look at personal financial statements, taxes, business financial statements. If we need to rely on projections to demonstrate that the company can repay it, we'll make sure that those appear to be reasonable. And then we basically allow the bank and the business to negotiate the terms of that repayment. We stay out of that portion of it. And to qualify, basically, the borrower then pays the state a fee, an insurance fee, if you will. And depending on the credit product that we're looking at, that fee varies from about 1.5% to 3.5% of the total amount of the insured loan. That money basically, with all of our other programs, goes into the fund itself. It's used to cover our costs of administration and also covers our losses. To date, we historically have been seeing that this program's operating at a break even, which means we're collecting enough fees and we're taking the right amount of risk based on the amount of capital that we currently have available. As far as how this program works, when we see economic good times, this program is really helping support business growth. When we see economic downturns, a lot of this program and other programs really focus on business retention. And so rather than buying fixed assets and equipment, we're working it with them to provide them working capital to continue supporting payroll, inventory, receivables, and things like that.
But these businesses qualify on their own for the loan. I'm trying to understand why the state. So if you're going through this analysis, and they have to show their creditworthiness to the state to also do this. They obviously have done that to the lending institution. So I'm trying to understand then what is there about this program that, why do we do it?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, I would say that these projects are nearly bankable. The bank basically says, in order to make this loan, I need a little bit more assurance if there is a default.
Okay, thank you.
So much like the last program, I would say we know that the program is working based on program demand. I would say we have more capacity right now than we have in the past, and a lot of that is because more businesses are healthy and lenders are taking on a little bit more risk. If there's a default, and this does happen on occasion with this program, like the Capital Access Program, we determined that a portion of the project isn't eligible, or more commonly, that the bank didn't take all the steps it should have to get fully repaid through the liquidation of assets and things like that, we actually will reduce the amount of the guarantee that's paid. Again, we don't want to just stop payment because that doesn't leave a very good taste in the mouth of the lender. But at the same time, we have to work with what is a reasonable loss if the lender would have taken the right steps. With this program, it's very important that we work very closely with the lender. We actually ask that they notify us within 30 days of a default. And from there, we just stay with that loan. And as things escalate, we make sure that we're in agreement with the steps that they're taking so that when they do submit a claim, we're there, we're ready to pay. In most instances, we get a claim and we're processing that payment to the financial institution about a week. So it is a pretty quick process. Okay. So with that, we move on to loans where the state is actually providing a loan to a small business. We really have three different types of lending programs here. We'll walk through them independently, but again, very similar to our last program. These are programs where, because of the risk is real to the state, we're fully underwriting these credits and assessing the credit risk. Each one of these programs has a different risk profile because they're serving a different borrower, and we kind of underwrite to those standards. The very first one that we'll talk about is the Oregon Business Development Loan Fund. This is our oldest direct loan fund, established in 1983, and it essentially was designed to help support traded sector activity in rural communities. And specifically, this program funds capital gaps when a business doesn't necessarily have enough equity to put into a project. A good example of this would be a business that is acquiring a new facility, whether it's a commercial retail storefront, or actually it'd have to be a manufacturing facility because it's traded sector, and they only have 20 or 10% of capital to put down. Most lenders will require 20 to 30% cash injection to get to an advance rate that's acceptable to them. So we help fill that gap of the 10 to 20% of capital that the borrower doesn't have to help fully fund the project. With this, we actually underwrite the projects. The repayment is tied to the useful life of the assets. So on real estate, 20-year loan. On equipment, most of the time we're looking at 5, 7, 10 years. And we have a fixed interest rate that's advantageous to the borrower. The interest rates are actually below market right now. Today's rate is at 4%. Most lending out there available is around 6, 6.5%. And one of the benefits to this is that it helps businesses, again, with a lower blended cost of funds, allows them to retain more capital, which allows them to grow their business and invest back in their companies. So with this project, when we are approached by a business, we ask them to identify the gap so we can fund up to 40% of a project. But we work with the lender and the borrower to understand exactly how big that gap is. For the most part right now, we're funding gaps that are about 15 to 20% on a project. So we're not really doing our max. And again, we're filling the gap that the lender can't provide on the particular project. With these loans, and this is going to be the case with this program and with the next two, is we actually have loan agreements and documents. We ask for personal guarantees and corporate guarantees. If a borrower defaults on it, it's usually going to be a payment default. Then we're going to pursue our collection activities. Because our role is economic development, we're really not in the business of shutting businesses down. We'd like to work with them and negotiate a repayment, ultimately to make sure that the state gets repaid over time. So we do have some flexibility to work with those borrowers. And oftentimes that's good because it gives them 12, 14, 18 months sometimes to get to a healthier place. And often they then resume payments as agreed. In the event that a business isn't going to make it, we work with them to liquidate their assets. And ultimately for us, the most important thing is open communication. As soon as that does go away, we do have to use and enforce what provisions are allowed by law in our loan documents. And we'll work with the Department of Justice to basically go and get judgments, if you will, on the business assets or pursue repayment through the personal or corporate guarantees as appropriate. With these programs in general, we do have losses. Typically, they're under 2% across the board if you took all of our programs. I think we're doing a good job. This particular program has grown pretty well over the years. It has about a 2% growth year over year based on interest income and things of that nature.
So these loans are in second position to the primary lender?
Correct. They are generally subordinate to that private lender.
So I'm afraid we are out of time. We have 2 o'clock to get to. Really, this is great information, and I wish we could get through, and maybe we, during the interim, can come back and finish up, because I think it's been very helpful. It gives us more things to talk about and understand the programs. So we'll make a marker at where we're at, and then we'll talk again before we come back in September and finish up. But this is very good information. It's very helpful to understand how the programs work, and in some cases, reinforcing especially why we do it. So I do appreciate that. I'm going to close the informational. Thank you, members. This is our last meeting. I wish there was more members here, but nonetheless, it is. Thank you all for your good work on this committee. Hopefully, we'll all get back here in September, and we can do some more good work. I would just encourage you. They've provided us, we have several lists from Business Oregon of all the things they do, and we've been talking about some of those, but I'd encourage you to look at those lists in the interim, too, before we come back, if there's other questions or areas we want to understand better. And then just like Representative Marsh did in one of the programs we talked about, if there's things you want to talk about that maybe we need to tweak or talk about, we can put that on the list. Okay? Very good. We're adjourned. Thank you.